Dunwell is a so-called roguelike game, originally designed for the mobile, like iOS and stuff like that. And so it's a side-scrolling roguelike platformer where you drop down a well.
So the first thing I thought when I played this game was, why on earth is this guy leaving his beautiful life in the above world where there's a nice tree, a nice bench to relax? Why is he jumping into this well?
I don't know. Can I spoil the story
or not? Right. So I eventually found out why.
Yeah.
So I don't think it would be fair to spoil the story. But I guess maybe one thing we could say then is that it's not a bottomless pit.
No, it's a rescue mission of sorts, I guess.
Yeah. Right. And I had no clue. And then when I saw it, I was like, okay, all right, now I understand why. Maybe I might do the same. Maybe I would jump down in that well as well for the same reasons.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I would totally do that.
Yeah, for sure. So what inspired such a game?
Oh, actually, even though I did the sound design for Dunwell, and Ojiro did the programming and the game design, and even though I've seen his talks and interviews about it, I still don't really remember why he wanted to make the game. But he did. It's good.
Yeah. I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
So you how much influence did you have on the actual game itself?
Okay, so at first Ojiro had made probably like, I don't even know, like 10 revisions at least on the game. And then I met him in GDC at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. Was it 2015? Yeah, last year's GDC I met him over there and at a Devolver party. And then I tried his game. I was like, oh, wow, what is this? And I played it a bit and I was like, oh, man, is someone doing sounds for you? And he's like, nope. And then he like looked at me like, do you want to do sounds for it? I'm like, yes, I do. And then, and at the same time, I was hanging around with my good friend Eirik Suhre, who does music. He did music for Spelunky, and he made a track for Hotline Miami and stuff like that. And I was hanging around with him, and then he tried the game too, and he was like, so who's doing music? And the same thing happened, and Eirik became the composer for Dunwell. So then a few weeks after GDC, we got like our contracts sorted and so on and so on and so on. We started working on the game. So, pretty much how it went, at first, Ojiro had a bunch ready and we just worked on top of that. But then we kind of hang out in Skype and stuff all the time and just would bounce ideas back and forth. And some of those ideas would end up in the game. Some would influence stuff that were already in the game. So it was really organic. Like, all three of us making the game, we all kind of had our own small influence over the overall experience.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Do you have programming experience yourself? I mean, like, could you program?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I've made my own games. Actually, it's kind of a funny thing. Like, I made my own games for way more years than I've done sounds for games. But people know me as a sound designer for games. But like, a lot of people don't know about my, like, own games side, except for now, because I'm making my own, my first own commercial game called Tormentor X Punisher, published by Raw Fury. So, yeah, I also make games myself.
Most developers, they have, like, prototypes of games. Even if it's, like, incomplete, they might have something on Kongregate or something along those lines. Do you have anything like that?
There used to be this old Yo-Yo Games. Really,
I love these games, by the way. I love when they're like these old things, and it's like it really means nothing.
Yeah, exactly. It's I don't think it was even called Yo-Yo Games back then. It was or maybe I can't remember. It was like the old Game Maker forums. So I had some stuff over there. They had like this portal where you could play Game Maker made games. I had some stuff over there, and then I had some games posted in a small forum called Poppincast. But other than that, it was just random game forums. I didn't really have like web page hub that I would use. It was just random stuff.
So do you think if I try to hunt those games down and try to like see them, you think they'll still be there?
Probably not.
I'm going to try anyway.
Like, a lot of the forums I were at were like super old forums, like really, how would I explain, like really, like not that huge user bases, and a lot of them have just disappeared, pretty much.
Yeah, yeah, I can imagine. I'm guessing when you first saw this game at GDC, pretty much the design was already there, the main frame of the game. Do you know what may have inspired the vertical design? How come he didn't decide to pick up the full screen?
So the game was I think the original like idea for Ojiro was to make a game for the phone, like a phone, like an iPhone, pretty much. And then he was like, all the designs in the game kind of cater to you playing on a mobile phone. So that's why it only has three buttons: it's left, right, and jump. And the jump also acts as a shoot button. So you only have like, he said he wanted only a maximum of three buttons in the game for the like core gameplay. And then the Tate mode, so-called Tate mode, which is, you know, the flipped screen. So you have like longer screen.
Yeah, you can flip the screen as
So that just makes sense in a mobile game.
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, you hold your phone normally like that. So I guess
that's the reason.
Pretty much. Yeah. That's probably the reason. Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask if it was originally designed for a phone first, because I played this on the PlayStation 4, and the controls are perfect, right? I couldn't imagine doing this on the phone. Did you guys have some different version of controls for the phone at some point, and then you actually decided to go with the touchscreen controls?
I think it was touchscreen since day one.
Okay. I appreciate the full price for the full game, rather than like a free-to-play game or something like that.
Yeah, I'm the same.
Did you guys consider an option like that?
I don't think that. I mean, I don't know for sure, but I don't think that was in the thoughts. I think it was always supposed to be like a premium game, so to say.
Okay, good.
I think. Like, I can't answer for them, but I think, because we never talked about free-to-play mechanics or anything. It was always about, you know, just the game.
When you look at this game, it's something about it spells, okay, free-to-play. Come to me, free-to-play. But no, not at all. And I'm really happy that it's not free-to-play.
Yeah, I have a personal issue with free-to-play games. I've never really got in. Like, there are some games that pull it well, like Hearthstone, for instance. That's a game that kind of works for free-to-play, but I think the reason why Blizzard could do a good free-to-play game is because they were already a huge, massive, successful company.
Right.
They already had like the money behind to do a game that is essentially free-to-play. It's like you don't really need to use any money for the game. Like everything you spend is just for, you know, extra.
Right.
You don't really need to use your money except for the adventure thingies, but they're like almost like their own games already. So yeah, it's kind of a game that I think caters well for that. But then there's a bunch of other free-to-play games. Like, that's one of the biggest reasons why I don't really play mobile games myself that much.
Me too.
It's like, I used to be way into that stuff. Like, when mobile games started popping up, and I was like, oh, wow, I can play a action on my phone. I was like, oh, this is the greatest. But then suddenly, the trend of like free-to-play started popping up, and it was like, I can almost play the game, but I have to pay to get this thing, then I have to pay to get that thing, and then I have to wait 20 minutes and watch ads or pay a euro or something like that. It's like, oh man, that's not really fun anymore. It's just weird.
You're literally paying to progress, and
yeah,
absolutely.
yeah, it's not really my thing.
Yeah. With so many color palette choices, how come the red one was the default one?
I think that's just how he made the game first. Actually, I remember when palettes came. That was just the general art style he had, Oyiro had in mind. And I guess red is, I don't know this for a fact, but I think it's pretty universal that it's like, actually, no, somewhere I read that it's actually kind of a happy thing in China or something. Well, I think it's just because, you know, red is dramatically different to black and white. So I guess it's just a color, just like aesthetically a color that works in that kind of palette. Like pops out, and I don't know, but I don't know why. But I remember when the palettes came, and that was like, oh yeah, I was like, oh man, should I have done this and this color? And then he was like, well, what if I just make a palette system, and then now you can choose what the game looks like yourself.
The default is my default as well. I can't play in any other color. I think once you get stuck to one, you kind of have to stick to it, because then you have to readjust your thinking a little.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's design, like, how I see it is, it's a bit like games. Like, one thing I don't like about games is having difficulty curves. You have, like, easy, normal, and hard, and then very hard. Because I don't know which one of these was the intended. Because, like, normal doesn't mean normal. For some games, hard is normal. And it's just, like, which one of these is the intended, like, experience. So I usually just take normal, and I just play along that. Okay, this is normal, like they say, normal. Like, I don't like difficulty curves. I like when it's, you know, the game, and then if you have, like, an extra hard mode, that's why. Because hard mode means it's just the same game, but harder.
When you're talking about it in terms like that, I'm thinking about Resident Evil. From my memory, maybe I'm wrong. Like, you start off, and you could just only select the standard difficulty. Maybe it's just me. I'm talking about the older games. Like, I just remember playing Resident Evil, and you started, and that was it. And then when you beat it, then you had the option of, of a different difficulty. And Grand Theft Auto, like, you literally, there's no menu. You just jump into the game.
Yeah.
Grand Theft Auto 3, that is. I'm old.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't played, like, the last Resident Evil I played was, like, number 4 for the Wii, and I played that for like 2 minutes, so I don't really have that many memories of Resident Evil.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, I played number 2 a lot when it came out on PS1, I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, that's how I think. Like, it's kind of wrong to say that's how games should be, but I don't know. To me, that feels like, I mean, you know, it's the intended experience.
Yeah. I totally get what you're saying. Did you guys learn anything from using palettes? From using, like, different shades to, like, maybe show depth or something along those lines?
I don't know. I can't answer.
Yeah.
I can't answer.
Yeah.
No, sound-related questions are easier.
Yeah. I know. I didn't quite understand the wall jump. Like, when you jump, you could jump from the wall, but you can only do it once per jump. Do you know what the reason for that was?
So the funny thing about wall jump is, we made the game, and I didn't even know we had a wall jump until I saw other players do it. So I have no idea. To me, it was like, I worked on the game and I didn't know there was a wall jump, so you know, to me, like, design wise I can't even remember. I hope we have a sound for it.
No, I don't know. I don't think there was. I don't know.
To me, it's like, because usually when I work with developers, I ask for a list of all the actions that you can perform in the game. Like, you know, open a door, fall down or like jump or double jump, triple jump, and so on. So that was like not in the list, and we never talked about it, and it never really came up, and I never thought to do it myself, because kind of, you know, it's one of those like skill moves, you have to really master the trick to make it happen. And I never even knew it was possible, so I never did it. So so it's one of these things, I saw some streamer play and they did a wall jump. I was like, what? Oh no. And then I realized, oh no, I don't think I have a sound for that.
Yeah, I think it just might be like a regular jump sound. Yeah. In fact, the first time I did it, I didn't realize I did it. And then when I did it again, I questioned if I had like some special power up or something, and I just didn't know. But no, I think that's how it is. I know a lot of these you may not be able to answer, but thankfully they're not too many more questions. So I mean, you know, I really try to think about the questions I ask. So I'm gonna ask you anyway, and what I could get from it, I'll be more than happy to remain with it.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's kind of fun. This is actually way different than a lot of other interviews I've had, so it's kind of fun. It gives me another perspective of answers.
Yeah. I guess it's not an interview. Like I'm not monetizing this in any way. I'm just kind of just doing it really to learn. Really,
yeah.
You know, not only about the game, but so that I could tell students about these experiences as well. The combo system effectively ends at 25. I mean, it keeps going, but
you don't get any upgrades.
Yeah, the benefits from it ends at 25. I could kind of see what the reason for this was, but there's no real incentive to kind of keep going further. Do you know why 25 was the end point?
I think this was asked from Ojiro once, and I recall him answering that he never expected anyone to go over 25. Like he was like he didn't expect people to get like so good at the game or something like that. So he was like, he just had it at 25. It's like, there's no point of adding any more. Like, what would it, like, no one's gonna get it or something like that. But people are getting like this is one run where someone gets like, is it 500 combo or something like that? And it's like never expect people something. They like, there's always someone who will.
Oh yeah,
for but sure. Yeah, I guess that's one of those things that it was more of a, it's like 25 is like kind of a rare thing to happen, unless I think he kind of designed the whole system before Limbo, because in Limbo you can get the, that's the last level set.
Yeah.
You can pretty much get high combos, but I guess in a sense it also kind of is, might even work as a balancing thing, where again in Limbo you can get easily like 40 to 50 combos if you like just continue going on, but at the same time it kind of makes the game somewhat easier. But I don't know the real reason. Like, that's the reason I still believe in.
I don't really do the leaderboard stuff, but I did do a little research, and I understand that there's a leaderboard, and that information is part of the leaderboard information. So so I, at least, you know, it's not for nothing. And it does keep counting. So I'm quite happy to end at 25, literally.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I highly recommend it. This YouTuber called Jorge Risto, HORHERISTO. He does crazy runs of video games, and his downwell like run where he never touches the ground until the game like makes you touch the ground.
That's impossible. Eventually. I have to see this now. This is incredible.
Yeah, that's a clutch moment. You watch, look at it, you're like, oh no. But you know he's going to make it, but even when you watch it, you're like, oh no, he's going to, no.
Wow.
So good.
Okay.
So good.
I have to see this. This is...
Yeah, it's insane.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong on this. I'm not sure if this is true, but I felt like there's a balancing system in the game. For example, If I'm playing with, let's say, the guy that you start off with that has 6 lives, it's slightly more difficult than if you start off with the guy with 4 lives. Is that true, or is that just me?
I think the game itself is the same. Like, yeah, I think it's the same. I think the game, I think the game is just, you know, either you're being really unlucky or...
No. I thought about it. I thought it was just me. But for some reason, you know, like, I don't know. I felt like it was a little bit more difficult when I chose that guy, but,
It could be, but I don't think so. I think it's the same, but, you know, because it's randomized elements and everything computing kind of affects stuff, so it might affect something in a computing level. But I don't know.
You know, speaking about randomly stuff, so I didn't write this question down, but I remember back in the days, not too back in the days, but before folks used to say procedurally generated, it was simply just randomly generated. Is there a difference in what those words mean, or is it just a more precise evolution of just terminology?
Actually, I wondered this myself. That's been a thing in my mind too. I think this is how I perceive it. Randomly generated means it's generated random, like a level. Let's say you have a like level 1, level 2, and so on and so on. Level 1, random generated. It generates it at the start of the level, and it's random. Like, you know, each time you start, it's random, like the positioning. But with procedurally, you would, let's say, only see a certain portion of a level, and when you move, it would, like, generate as you move the level. That's kind of how I see it.
That makes complete sense.
Yeah. That's how I feel it might be, but I don't know. It might also be, you know, just mixed in translation kind of a thing.
Yeah. But what you said makes complete sense, though. Interesting. Because I'm assuming in the earlier days of gaming, you know, it was like that, where you would generate the whole thing and then you play through it. And I'm not sure when this came in, but then, you know, it just so happened that folks started to actually just not do that. And, like, I guess maybe the computer was more powerful and they were able to stream it kind of as you go along.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
That's how I think of Bob. Then again, what do I know?
Right. It's all speculation.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to ask this one anyway. But now, you know, after getting a feel for talking to you and kind of understanding the game a little bit better, I could kind of see that there might not be an answer for this one. But different players play in different ways, right? And as a teacher, I'm kind of like thinking different students learn in different ways, or, you know, think differently as well. Was this a casual outcome of just having a variety of tools, or was it intended to, like, have people, like, choose their own way and go with it? Yeah, so I guess that question isn't very clear as well. So I was really just trying to ask if it was just a casual outcome that people that because there's so many tools, people could just kind of choose their tools, and kind of get into their own rhythm, rather than you know, just like have them play this certain way all the time.
Yeah, you mean in Downwell?
Yeah, in Downwell. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because you can choose in the beginning, like, your mode. But then again, those are, like, unlocked, so I guess it was intended that you'd first play with your, like, normal mode. Pretty much. Like, you know, you start off with only the normal way to go down, and then you find weapons. And then you unlock these different player modes. And I guess they're more for, like, a challenge, or, like, just something to mix up the game a bit. Like, it's still the same game, but when you have, like, a character who can't get upgrades, or, for instance, or something like that, it already changes the dynamics of the game. So on and so on. So I guess it's just more of a, if you want to try and challenge yourself and play the game differently. Yeah. I guess that's pretty much the idea behind it. And it's like an easy way. Like, that's a game that for which something like that is easily done and changes the experience somewhat. So it's like, it makes sense to put it in.
How did the Time Void come to be?
So for design questions, Ojiro gave a really good GDC talk, or really fun and informative GDC talk. You can find it from the GDC vault, or probably YouTube even. Like, you just go Ojiro Fumoto Downwell GDC talk, or game developers talk. Mm. And he gave a good talk about the design of Downwell.
Really?
And he goes through the roots and the design elements and ideas for the game. It's really good.
Yeah.
Informative. Entertaining.
I'm gonna have to look that up. I didn't know.
Yeah, it's a good, like, is it like half an hour talk or so? Yeah, it's really good.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yes, so I can't remember Time Voids. I mean, Time Void was just to have like a kind of a room that gives you, you know, an upgrade or money or something, just for like more exploration. And then when it stops the time, it was just to make it kind of make more sense in the game world, kind of a thing. But I think he talks about that in the talk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sorry that I can't give a better answer.
Yeah, no. I totally get it. In the same line of thought, how did you guys come up with sushi or curry for Extra Life?
I mean, Ojiro is from Japan, so I guess it's local. Delicacy. Well, how do you say that word in English, actually? Delicacies? Like food?
Delicacies.
Delicacies, yeah, that's right.
I think so.
Language barrier.
I just thought that was interesting. Are there any Easter eggs or other things that a casual gamer may not easily be able to see?
Yes.
I've asked a similar question to someone else before, and the response was exactly the same. A long yes. Anything that you could give away, maybe, or hint at?
No.
Okay.
No, because actually, I don't even know how to get them. I know there is one, but like, even though I worked on the game, I'm still not sure how you access at least one of them. Mm. I don't know if this actually. I think there's only one Easter egg in the game, but I could be wrong. I mean, actually, I don't know. Are these really? I mean, there are a few Easter eggs in the game, and one is a thing that you have to somehow unlock, but I don't know how.
Mm.
That's. Like this is not me being coy, it's just I don't actually know, but then there's a few like cameo Easter eggs.
Really?
Huh. Yeah, like Limbo has drawings from other artists over there, like some of the things that you see might be from like different artists and like visual artists. Mm. And then in the Aquafire, the third level, the underwater one.
Mm-hmm.
There's a enemy that you can encounter that's from another game made by Yukio Kallio, me and Yukio Kallio, called Scoober.
Huh.
Small jam game. You might see like one of the enemies from Scoober.
Okay.
It's like a small Easter egg. Like,
yeah,
that.
No. That's. I'm guessing you wouldn't really know about the prototyping of the game. And of course, I could take a look at that video that you mentioned before. Do you know if there are like any playable prototypes of Downwell that might be available online or something?
I don't know. I don't think so. But maybe. I think like Ojiro did a thing before Downwell where he made, was it one game a month for a year or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of those might have been like a really, really early, not really a prototype for Downwell, but something that Downwell kind of took off from.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he goes through that in his GDC talk as well. Mm. I mean, the talk goes through the different like prototype phases, and the game was way different when he started out. There was no shooting, no... I don't think it even had enemies. I mean, just running away from boulders, stuff like that. So yeah, that's a really interesting video. You're going to see so many variations of the game until it kind of started to resemble the game. It's not...
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
How did you get into the gaming field?
I mean, I've always, you know, as a kid, I've always enjoyed video games. I always enjoyed making my own, like, pen and paper games, because I didn't know how to make video games. So I made my, like, own board games, pretty much. It's kind of funny, because I don't really play board games that much. But I enjoyed making them as a kid. And then I, you know, played a bunch of, like, Magic the Gathering and Warhammers and stuff like that. And then at some point, as a kid, I started to learn... No, actually, at first I had a demo CD that came with a demo version of, like, Click and Play or something like that. It was, like, this really old, like, 90s, like, make-your-own-game kind of a thing. Then I started making, like, really kind of awkward, like, rip-off games from other games. And then I had a few years of pause of making games, and then at, like, I don't know, I went to a vocational school where I did, like, computer, like, fixing computers and electronic stuff. And over there we had a course of Visual Basic, which is a coding, is it like library language? And then I made, like, text-based games on that. That was really fun. They were like text-based role-playing games. So I made maps. I kind of learned that from, I don't even know, from my cousin or something like that. And then, so Visual Basic, I was like, oh, wow, this reminds me of those mud times when I made mud games. And then I made, like, a few games on Visual Basic, and then at some point I started adding graphics to them. I was like, oh, man, this is fun. Then I, again, had a few years of pause, and then I moved relatively close by to where Yukio Kallio lives. Yukio Kallio is a video game composer. He did music for Nuclear Throne and Luftrausers and stuff like that. And this was back in 2009. Yeah, 2009. I moved next door to him, and then I was like, hey, I live pretty close by. Want to grab coffee or something? He's like, yeah. Then we went to have coffee and lunch, and then we talked about making video games for some reason. I don't even know how we ended up talking about video games, but we did. And then Yukio said that he makes his own games. I was like, oh, wow, I used to make games. What do you make games in? He's like, oh, I use this program called Game Maker. I was like, oh, man, can you show me how Game Maker works someday? And then he did, and I was sold. I was like, oh, man, yeah, I'm going to do this. And I made so many games from, like, 2009 to 2011, like, pretty recently. That's kind of when I rebooted my game-making hobby. And then I made, like, I don't know, crazy amounts of games. I went to, like, a bunch of game jams and stuff. Like honestly, I probably made, like, I didn't even know, like, 100 to 150 game jam games.
Oh, wow.
Just, you know, some, like, small games. Because we used to have, like, then I went to, like, different forums, and different forums we used to have, like, game jams, which were, like, you only have 4 hours. 4 hours to make a game from start to finish. Go. And it's like, oh, wow, okay, I only have 4 hours. So you'd make a bunch of, like, small games. But, like, working on those 4 hour, 2 hour, even 1 hour jams or weekend long jams and stuff like that, they just, you know, boost your routines. Like, you just start creating stuff faster, and when you are in that mindset of, okay, I'll make this, if it doesn't work, it's not the end of the world, I'll just reiterate that later on or something like that. You kind of get that whole thought process of making stuff ready and then fixing it if it's not good enough. And yeah, so I made a bunch of games, and then we kind of there was this thing called Indie Beer, which is like indie, like independent developers in Helsinki meeting up with each other. It's hosted by Petri Purho. He made Crane Physics and Jesus vs. Dinosaurs and like games like that. He made a bunch of games. Mm. And he started hosting this Indie Beer thing back in 2012. And then I started attending those with Yukio, and then I already, like, I've done, like, outside of, like, game stuff, I did music and, like, live mixing of bands, and I made albums and produced, like, albums with bands, and I played in bands myself. Like, I had a whole, like, music background behind me that's always kind of been, like, my driving thing, and then, like, some years ago, I decided to do like sounds for movies and stuff. Like, I really want to get into movies and TV productions and stuff. And I started a vocational school in 2009 to kind of boost up my sound skills and kind of learn into the TV world a bit more. And I got into a school, and that's the same time I started making my own games, 2009, like in a more proper fashion. And I started making sounds for my own games. And then people, like back then, like let's go forward a few years. Sorry, this is a bit winding here and there. I hope this makes
sense. Yeah, it is.
Then, so yeah, let's go forward to 2012 in the beer. Like, so people knew I do sounds for games and I make my own games as well. But the sound thing is what kind of stuck into people's heads. They were like, oh, you make sounds for games. Like, there's not that many people that kind of, like, there's a bunch of people who make sounds for games, but not that many people seem to really travel around to events and stuff. So it was kind of, in a sense, maybe even like somewhat exotic to people. They're like, oh wow, sounds for games. And they're like, well, our games need sound. And so in Indie Beer, I kind of became that sound guy who makes sounds, not just music, but sounds for games. And Indie Beer, I met into this guy named Johannes Vuorinen, and we talked a bit, and then he was like, oh, so you make sounds for games? I'm like, yep. So we have this game that needs sounds. Do you want to come to our office and check it out? I was like, yeah, yes, I do. And then I went to their office, and they were making this game called Badland, which was a huge mobile hit. And it wasn't released, and it was still like, they were still like prototyping it, or like working on it. And I made a demo for the game, and they were like, yeah, so do you want to work on the game? I'm like, yes, I do. And and then that was pretty much my first commercial game I worked on. Like, I had done all these game jams and like jam games and whatever, and this was my first commercial game in 2012. And it became, luckily to me, a massive hit.
Yeah.
Wow. And the same I worked on. I mean, then again, I also knew like the Vlambeer guys who made Nuclear Throne and Luftrausers and Super Crate Box and so on, Ridiculous Fishing. I knew them from like the game jam scenes as well. So as I was making Badland, they were making this jam game for Mojam. And I joined that, and that became Waste and Kings, which then later on turned to be Nuclear Throne. And Nuclear Throne was also a pretty big hit. So I was kind of lucky to have my first two proper commercial games to be like pretty successful.
Really? Wow. Wow. Luck or what? I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, at first, like, thing is, I mean, it's kind of weird. It's luck. I would say it's like 60% luck to meet people. Then it's 40%, like 50% luck, 50% of
skill.
You deciding what to do with that luck.
Okay. Oh yeah.
Like,
right.
Communication and like deciding things and prioritizing things. It's like, what a ride! Like with Nuclear Throne, we made that game for 3 years, and
wow.
During those years, I would go to events a lot. I would also go to events to promote Badland as well. I'd meet people at events, like. While working Nuclear Throne, I got to work on so many other games just by going to events and stuff. Like, I worked on a game called Broforce as well. And those guys I met while showing Nuclear Throne in Florida at Minecon. stuff like that. It's like, you know, it's weird luck meeting people at different events and, you know, just talking to people and hoping the best.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. It's,
that's
been a good ride.
Yeah. No kidding. That's some story.
Yeah. Wow. But it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's, for sure. It's not, you know, just, you know, snap fingers, things are done. It's a lot of work maintaining and, like, working healthily and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, at first I was, like, just, you know, working on everything full blast. At some point I realized I'm getting kind of tired of stuff, even though I should be enjoying this. So then I started taking weekends off free and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's...
Oh, yeah. You definitely need those weekends off.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like working out, you know, you can't work out 24/7. You need rest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Any thoughts on Nintendo Switch and would Downwell come to it?
Wow. I cannot answer for the Downwell thing. I do not seriously know about that. But I have no idea. I hope so, but I don't know.
Yeah.
So, the Switch, wow. Any thoughts about it? Like, I haven't seen... Okay, what I can say is I haven't seen it with my very own eyes. So I can't say really anything. It's like, I mean, I've seen videos before about games and game consoles and stuff, and... promotional videos are a way another story than an actual product.
Right. Right.
I mean, there's a video called Ubisoft Downgrades that tells a lot.
I'll write that down now.
So that's how I see marketing videos and like marketing events. Like something that's shown in E3 is probably not the experience you'll see on a released thingy. That's also, like, now that I'm making my own commercial games, that's my kind of... My idea is not to do promotional films that kind of don't show the game as the game. Like, if I do a game, like, you know, gameplay... a gameplay trailer, I would just show the actual gameplay instead of, you know, like, kind of sugarcoating it.
Yeah. I always prefer to see some gameplay footage over a trailer.
Yeah.
And even then, you know, you're not quite sure what you're really seeing.
Yeah.
Until you play it.
Yeah. But as an idea, Switch is pretty brilliant. Like, the idea is good, but I mean, will it work? We'll see. Like, I would love to play stuff like, well, okay, Skyrim is kind of getting a bit old, but I would love to play, like, games of that caliber, like on a plane or something. That would be brilliant. But...
yeah.
And the new Zelda looks pretty good.
Yeah.
It actually looks like a Zelda that I might enjoy. Like, I'm a bit of a weird person. I don't really enjoy Zelda games.
Is that so?
Yeah, I just never got it. The puzzles are always... they're trying to be smart, but when you try to apply another solution for the puzzle, it just doesn't work. Which kind of sometimes breaks the feeling of a coherent world. Like, there's a few Zelda games where, like, oh no, what a rant. There's going to be a rant about Zelda now. People are going to hate me. So, so on Ocarina of Time, there's a thing that I hate over everything. So, it's one of the first puzzles, even. Like, when you have to get inside the fish dude's belly.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Something. Yabu or something like that. And you have to... bring forth a fish to him to eat, and then he'll, you know, open his mouth and you get in. And there's a fishing place, and I thought for the longest time I just have to catch a fish and then bring that fish to the dude, like the fish lord, whatever. And I could never, like, when you catch a fish, you try to go away with it, but then there's someone stopping you, like, oh, here, oh, you catched a fish and it weighs 2 kilograms or something. I'm like, yeah, cool, but I need to take this fish to the Lord Fish Dude, and then the game just wouldn't let me do that, and I was stuck for the longest time. I'm like, so I fish for the fish, I should take the fish to that person, but that person is stopping me. How do I do this? I tried to, like, find all the possible routes to how to eat the fish and stuff like that. But apparently, like, then, like, I just couldn't get free. And this was, like, the new one, the 3DS version of the game. And I'm like, oh, how do I do this? And then I had a friend who played Zelda previous. And he's like, oh, you have to drink the milk carton. And then with the milk carton, you have to pick up a fish from this pond over here. I'm like, what? that's what? Just couldn't believe it that was the actual puzzle. It just doesn't make sense. And then there's another Zelda game, the top-down one, Link Between Worlds. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one...
For the 3DS you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I play most of my games these days with, like, either 3DS or PS Vita. The travel a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
In that game, there are these switches that you have to, like, hit with something and they turn... you know, from, I don't know, red to blue or something like that. And there was this one switch, and I found a way to... I thought I found a way to activate switches, because that same tactic worked for other exactly same switches in another puzzle, but then I found the way to use that way in another puzzle with switches, which should have worked, because the game is like, clever, you used that physical thing to do that, and I tried to use that in another puzzle and just wouldn't work, and that kind of broke the illusion of, you know, this, you're like, you know, being smart in that world. Instead of being smart, you have to follow their exact ways of solving the puzzle. And then it's okay, like, as a game design, that's a good thing, but when they're trying to sell me a world that's kind of open to you to experiment, but then your experiments don't work because they decided it wouldn't work here, kind of just breaks it to me.
I totally get what you're saying. And, you know, while you're talking about this, I keep thinking in my mind, the analog to like when I'm teaching a math lesson.
Yeah.
You know, students tend to think in one direction rather than, you know, oh, there are so many different ways you could approach this one question. How to find that one angle over there. You don't have to do this one thing.
Yeah.
And it's funny that you mentioned that part about catching the fish. Now, I played this on a Nintendo 64 when it first released. And I think I actually got stuck at that same part. Only because I remember trying to catch a fish and trying to get away out of that place with that fish. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. It's just, I don't know, it's one of, I mean, and that's not the only puzzle. There's a bunch of puzzles like that in the game that just, you know, ruin it for me. And I tried other Zelda games, but I always kind of had the same feeling that there's always, like, they're trying to convey everything to be clever, you know. That was clever, you used fire on a, like, cobweb and that you get through, but... Then you try the same thing on another puzzle where it should work realistically. Then the game doesn't register it, and it's like, oh, I came up with this solution, but this solution didn't work. And to me, that's
I understand. Like,
I don't know, this is something that throws me off.
Yeah. Any hidden gems? And when I mean hidden gems, I mean, like, what are some games that you personally like that most people wouldn't know about? And it could be, like, from any time range.
Oh, now you opened a chest full of games that never left Finland. So, no, I
those are fine
really, too. I really, really like old 90s DOS games. Like 90s was pretty much the era that I grew up in.
Yeah.
I was born in 1987, so my thinking age was like pretty much throughout the 90s. And so that's when I started discovering video games more and more and more, and I played mostly on PCs. Like, I had a Nintendo, I had a Mega Drive, and I had a PlayStation, but I always kind of was drawn into playing on computers. And like, then just the scene around me, I knew a lot of people who made games or like did music for games and stuff like that as a kid, and I just got really easily into that culture of like looking at people making games and like releasing their own games and then playing those. I really got to play a bunch of cool games like this. This game series called Tapan Kaikki, a Finnish game series. That's if you translate it, it's a really dumb name. Tapan Kaikki means I kill all. It's a dumb name for a game, but it's a cool top-down shooter game. It's pretty much like Hotline Miami meets... Well, it's like Hotline Miami, but, like, you know, 12 years before Hotline Miami.
Hmm.
No, 16 years before Hotline Miami and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just such a cool game.
That's an actual release game? Or is that...
It's not... like published by anyone. It's like DOS games back in back then. Mm-hmm. But you can find this on the internet. That's still playable. And then there was like some bigger published games like Abuse. That was a really good game.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horrible name for a game, by the way. Horrible thing to Google. But the game itself is like Alien vs Predator, but good. Like really good. And oh man, so I mean, I can't even think. Then there was like Warcraft 2.
Yeah.
I played Warcraft 1. I didn't really get into that heavily, but Warcraft 2 was like mind-blowing.
Hmm.
And Diablo. Like, I've always liked Blizzard games for some reason. They're really polished and good quality.
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, what else? There's so many games. So many games to say that it's, you know, hard to come up with. And I really loved Super Nintendo era stuff. I never had a Super Nintendo, which I only got to play them at, like, you know, fairs or like random friends' places a bit. Like, I used to play like Mega Man X. Always when I saw Mega Man X, I'd be like, oh, I need to play this. Just being blown away by stuff like Super Castlevania and stuff like that. It's just, it's way, way, way cool.
I think you did yourself a disservice by not having a Super Nintendo.
Yeah. Then again, I got the Mega Drive at some point, and I was really like, I saw it in a shop in a store, like when Mega Drive came out, and they had like Sonic being like the mascot, like the Super Mario of Sega, and I was like, oh, the colors, these are amazing. And then we got a secondhand Mega Drive from my cousin. And a TV from my cousin, and I was like going right into my room. I was like, oh, this is a dream come true. Then I plug in the TV, and something had happened on the way back home. And my TV was black and white. I had no colors. I was like, oh no, where are the colors? Sonic, no. And I played Mega Drive black and white. Like,
wow.
Like, half of my PlayStation era, I played black and white. And it sucked.
Yeah, that must be the craziest story I've heard in a while.
Yeah.
No.
So sad.
Wow.
So
sad. I feel sorry for you.
Well. Oh, actually. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Quickly. Mm-hmm. Quake 1, the multiplayer of Quake 1, that I played, like the Quake Team Fortress, I played that a bunch at school. We used to stay at school, like, we had a pretty modern school, it was like a really new school, and we had a bunch of computers and internet at the school, and it feels weird to say those things now, but, like, they're like, every school has that these days, but back then they didn't. And then, so when school would end, we would actually hide in the school building, and when everyone left, we would just stay over and play Quake Team Fortress. For hours inside the school secretly.
Wow, that's crazy. Right? But what wasn't Quake, even Quake 1, wasn't that like a game rated? Well, was it even rated? I don't even know.
I don't know.
I'm surprised I would be in a school.
oh yeah, it was. So the thing is, which when you have like kids and computers.
Mm.
Especially at that time when computers weren't really that widely used, like in households and stuff, we knew the computers better than the teachers did. So, you know, we just hid the games.
I see.
They didn't know they were even in the computers until someone got busted from playing, like, Counter-Strike or something.
You got some good stories, man. You have some really good stories. So, I was going to end the interview there, but it would be really bad if I didn't mention anything about the music. of Downwell.
Oh yeah.
Because the music in Downwell it's nice. It's really well done. It gives you a good sense of atmosphere. Could you? I don't really have any questions about it. Is there any type of history about it that you could give?
So the music was composed by Eirik Suhre, so the guy who made music for Spelunky, Hotline Miami, Super Crate Box, and stuff like that.
Mm.
So and also Ridiculous Pitching. He did the music. I did the sound design. So I did all the jumps, okay, shooting, enemies dying, and like all those sounds.
Mm.
And he did the music, and we both jammed at the same time. So how I like to work on sounds, like doing the overall sound design, I like to work with the composer directly. So we both work at the same time and like going through the same, like we go through, how do I say, it's like design ideas of like how much bass they will use on a track. So I know how much bass to use on my sound effects for that level and stuff like that. I kind of like to make things a neat packet.
Mm-hmm.
So we went through like a bunch of design ideas, and the music, they came pretty organically. Like Eirik wanted to do something kind of Metroid-y and kind of like so-called quotation mark gangster sounding, like he wanted like that, like groovy feeling, but also have the melancholy of like Metroid game series, and then he kind of jammed around some ideas, and like me and Ojiro would kind of go like, oh man, this is cool, and could you do that and that, and then he would like give us versions, and we'd be like, oh, that version definitely, and he'd be like, ah, okay, and then he would jam on that. We just, you know, for everything, the game design, the sounds, and the music, we just bounce around ideas, and we could all influence each other, and you know, it's pretty free. We could do like, someone could just say, ah, would you try this thing, and then they would try, and it either worked or it didn't, but you know, we all worked with each other, and I think that's why, I think you can see that in like Downwell, like we worked together and we had fun just, you know, creating it. Yeah,
wow. I mean, that's the best type of work environment anyone could have.
Yeah and I think it's, you know, just being open, like just being open to the team and kind of leaving so-called egos at home. Like, just, you know, just working and being, having an open mind. Like, if someone, let's say you work on a game and someone is like, let's say you're working as a composer in a game and someone comes like, oh, could you try maybe adding a violin thing over here? And you're like, well, violin? Oh, I didn't think of that. And then you're like, well, okay, I'll try and see if something happens. And it either works or it doesn't, but like at least you tried that idea to see if it could somehow work, and sometimes they do, sometimes they just take the whole thing to another level. And same with like game design, if you're making a game, programming a game, and someone's like, oh, could you add a triple jump after a jump, double jump, and you're like, I don't know, it will probably not work, but and if you stay in that zone, you'll never really progress, I don't think. Like, if you go like, oh, well, I'll try, let's give it a try, let's see if it will break puzzles or something, then you add that third jump and you're like, oh wow, this made the game feel way better, like, then you learned something.
Speaking about adding stuff, was there anything that you guys thought about adding and it didn't, you guys ended up not adding it in?
Oh, yes, I kind of remember having something. Yes, the shopkeeper. You could actually steal from the shopkeeper.
What?
Yeah, you could actually steal from the shopkeeper, and he would get mad at you, and he would attack you. And the shopkeeper would, like, it would defeat you. Like, you, I think you had like a slight chance of winning the shopkeeper, but ultimately the shopkeeper would always win. They would always punish you. So instead of having that, now you just have the shopkeeper looking at you like angrily when you jump over the shopkeeper.
But you can't steal from him at all.
No. Yeah. You could. Like when I played the game the first time, you could steal from the shopkeeper.
But you can't now with the finished release game.
No, you can't.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah,
you can jump over the shopkeeper and just look at you with a frown.
Yeah,
that's it.
So you created the little sound effect that goes with him being mad.
Yeah.
That's very cute.
Yeah, actually, sound-wise, the game was really fun to make because many people, like a lot of people, come to me like, "Oh man, how did you make those?" Cause they kind of a lot of people expected that I used a program called SFXR, which is like OBFXR, which are like, you know, synthesized generators for like bits, like 8-bit style sounds and stuff. But I didn't use that at all, actually. Most of like pretty much like 90% of the sounds are recorded sounds, you know, just a microphone, me recording stuff, but I recorded them in weird angles and kind of recording stuff so-called in a wrong way, so to say, quotation marks. But I recorded stuff in a weird way that made things sound more like cheapy or like old, you know, old games. But they're mostly like recorded sounds, just recorded in a weird way or processed in a weird way.
Wow.
Like resampled like that. And like the shopkeeper, that's actually my vocals. Just going like, oh, thank you. Like all the things that he says, like thank you, here you go and stuff. I actually said that, but it's just recorded and then warbled in weird ways to kind of sound like a synthesizer.
Interesting. Wow. Yeah, I would have never thought about it like that. I really thought it was like definitely something chippy-ish, you know.
Yeah.
Synthesize in some way.
Yeah, it's just real oddly recorded. And then for like a lot of sound effects, Eirik would record me a bunch of like weird sounds out of his Game Boy, and I would use those as the top layer of a sound. So that kind of gives the sounds a more rich, heavier, and more meaty sound, but it also has like that kind of Game Boy / Nintendo vibe to them. So yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, really interesting. Well, I mean that's really the end of the interview.
All right.
I just want to thank you again so much for giving me this time. I really appreciate it. I really, you know, I like to honor people's time because it's so precious. Like I know how difficult it could be. Thank you again so much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's. I mean, sorry it took so long to get it, you know.
No. It was that's not a problem.
Travels and
yeah.
Stuff, yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, well. Well, back to washing dishes for me.
Woke up this morning and your cat was gone.
It's time to
pick out your pallet, put your gun boots on.
You see the
bright moon, a crescent hung above the well. When you descend into the darkness where the monsters dwell.
Down well, down well, down well. You're going down well, down well, down well. You're going down well, down well, down well. You're going down well, down well, down well.
Perhaps you never should have lived so close
to a
well that devours what you love.
Side
of your original purpose.
Jump right.